UK Wine Show, show number 100, Ernst Lucen on Riesling. On this week's show,
with the Dr. Lucen estate, we grow only Riesling, you know. This is the most traditional grape variety in the area, and this is what the Mosel is famous for the Riesling.
And in the news, more Aussies turn to wine, and awards for top UK sommelier and international wine communicator are announced.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 100, for the 11th of April 2008. My name's Chris Scott.
And I'm Jane Scott.
And this week we're talking with Ernst Lucen on Riesling grapes. Ernst is a leading German producer in the Mosel, and he has a joint venture making wine in Washington State, USA. We talk with Ernst about Riesling and what he expects from Riesling in those different vineyards. But this is our 100 show, and a big thank you if you've listened to most of our shows, and a bigger thank you if you've made comments to me, good or bad, over the last 100 shows. I pretty much reply to everyone, and some make it onto the show as well. When we started the show almost 2 years ago now, I used to joke about reaching show number 100, and we're here now, so it's excellent and exciting news. The people who have been writing in generally quite like the technical shows, so if you want to hear more of those, you're going to get some. But if you like some of the softer interviews, then do write in so that we know that you want to listen to those as well. I'm always interested in trying something new. That said, in light of this as being our 100th show, we thought we'd change the news format a wee bit and see what you think. So, next up is the news, read by Jane, with comments by me.
Thanks, Chris. Well, the first story this week is news that the number of Australian wine producers is on the increase. This is despite all recent concerns over drought and water restrictions. Even taking closures and mergers into account, this year's Australian and New Zealand wine industry directory showed over 150 more wine producers, bringing the total to 2,299. But when you look at the stats, you'll see that 150 more producers probably won't make a huge difference. They're competing for just 10% of the total market. It's because there's only around 20 large companies in Australia that account for 90% of the domestic and export market combined. And the latest Australian wine export figures from the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation show a strong downturn in bulk shipments, which dropped by 30%. On the upside, though, regional and fine wines are doing well, accounting for 12% of export sales by value, with key regions being the Barossa Valley, McLaren Vale, Margaret River and Coonawarra. The UK is still the top export market for Aussie wine, though, and according to Wine Australia UK, the consumer's going to be seeing better quality wines coming out of Australia.
Cheers, Jane. It's a shame about bulk shipments going down. I think they're more environmentally friendly. Richard Smart, a viticulturalist we met at Barcelona Conference on Climate Change and we covered a couple of weeks ago, said that when shipping bottles around the world, you waste half the volume and half the weight in packaging. And RAP, the government-sponsored body, reckons that bringing in wine by bulk helps our local consumers because we use the local glass rather than bringing more glass into this country where we don't have any use for it. Back to you.
Moving on, the next story this week is that the UK Sommelier of the Year for 2008 has been announced. It's a guy called Geroid Devaney from Tom Aitken's Michelin-starred London restaurant. He beat 99 other entrants in the competition, which is run by the Academy of Food and Wine. The other two finalists were Isabel from Heston Blumenthal's Fat Duck in Bray and Cyril Thévenet of Hotel du Vin.
So how does it work, Jane?
Well, Chris, it all sounds pretty exciting. They had to compete against each other in front of a live audience and do a blind tasting. They had to give wine and food recommendations and correct errors on a wine list. Then, in the ultimate challenge, they had to pour a magnum of champagne into 16 glasses, ensuring that each glass was equal, no glass was filled twice, nothing was spilt, and the bottle ended up empty. It sounds to me like it's great content for one of our interactive shows.
Sounds like this Gerald fella is pretty skillful.
Yep, he must be. He's been the chief sommelier at Tom Aitken's restaurant since it opened in 2003, where he created a wine list of around 500 bins And most recently, he set up an all-English wine list at Tom's new fish and chip restaurant in Chelsea called Tom's Place, which has the aim of being as environmentally friendly as possible.
Any more news stories this week, Jane?
Yep, my final story this week is another award. This time it's the International Wine and Spirit Competition's Communicator of the Year 2008. The award has been given to the American wine writer, educator and broadcaster Karen McNeil. Karen hosts a nationwide TV series called Wine, Food and Friends with Karen McNeil and has been writing about wine for 30 years. But in 2007, as well as the TV series, she wrote and launched a wine studies course for a network of cookery schools and set up a week-long residential course on wine education in the Napa Valley. Karen's not that well known in the UK, but it's hoped the award will increase her profile. Other shortlist candidates were Jamie Good and Ollie Smith from the UK, James Halliday from Australia, and Canadian Natalie McLean.
Do you know of any other person who's won? I think Tim Atkin won last year when I entered it.
Yeah, he did. And previous winners include Hugh Johnson, Jancis Robinson, Oz Clark and Matthew Jukes.
They're all based in the UK, so it's nice to see another person from around the world winning. You've been on the judging panel. How does it work, Jane?
Well, entrants have to be nominated and then the IWSC draws up a shortlist of finalists. The nominees are invited to form a panel of judges and asked to put their case forward as to why their person deserves to win the award. The panel must then reach a consensus. It's not that easy when each person is fighting their own corner. I did my best for you, Chris, but obviously it wasn't good enough.
Cheers.
Okay, those are my top three stories for this week. But don't forget, there's more detail on the news at our website 3050.co.uk.
Well, what do you think about a slightly different style of news? I know it's a popular part of the show and I don't want to muck around with it too much, but if you like it, give us a call. You can contact me at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. And while you're online, why don't you vote in our new poll? This month, the poll is, wine is mainly sold in 750ml bottles, but some producers are putting it into 500ml bottles to share between two. Do you think small bottles are a good idea? The options are, yes, brilliant, I would buy them on a regular basis. Yeah, I'd buy them occasionally. No, I think offering some wines in different sizes would result in less choice. And no, I can't see a need for smaller bottles. While you're there, have a look around at some of the wine tastings we run, as it's 3050's wine tasting business that sponsors the show. 3050 is the leading UK wine tasting company for both corporate entertainment and home education and entertainment. We believe wine tasting should be fun, so again, please do bear us in mind if you know someone who's thinking about having a wine tasting in the UK. As part of the show, many of you will know we've been adding a spotlight section. This week is the spotlight on grape variety and wine region. Just so you know, all the technical spotlights, book reviews are written by myself, while Sandra Clements, our news reporter, writes the spotlights on region and grape varieties. This week's region is Beaujolais Village and the all-important Gamay grape. So, let's have the spotlight on Beaujolais Village. Beaujolais is a quantitatively important wine region in east-central France, due south of Mâcon, producing wine from the Gamay grape. For administrative purposes, this 34-mile stretch is often included in Burgundy, but Beaujolais' climate, topography, soils, and grapes are quite distinct. The climate is temperate and semi-continental, while the landscape in the north of the region is made up of rolling granite and schist hills with some limestone, while the south is flatter with richer soils, making lighter wines for early drinking. About half the region's wine is sold under the basic Beaujolais appellation, this mainly coming from the south Basse Beaujolais and the land immediately of the west and north-south auto route, Belleville. Beaujolais Village is the second most important appellation, accounting for about a quarter of production and located on the hillier northern part of the region. The vines for these wines grow in 28 communes, and if the wine is produced in just one village or commune, the name can be used on the label. The region's finest and most long-lived come from North Beaujolais' Cruz. 10 named villages whose wines merit their appellation are Chirobles, Saint-Amour, Brûlé, Côte de Brûlé, Fleury, Julinas, Chinas, Regnay, Morgan, and Moulin-Avent. Of course, the region also produces Beaujolais Nouveau, the youthful wine made for immediate consumption, released each November. This can either carry the Beaujolais, Beaujolais Village appellation, or Beaujolais Supérieur, which generally just means it's got a minimum of 10.5% alcohol. A small amount of white wine is made mainly from Chardonnay and labelled Beaujolais Blanc or Beaujolais Village. An even small amount of rosé. So that's the spotlight on Beaujolais. The next one is the Gamay grape. Gamay is the grape responsible for Beaujolais, and although it does pop up in a few other places, it's probably more than any other internationally known grape variety associated with a single wine region and a single wine type. Gamay is an early budder, flower, and ripener, making it prone to spring frosts. But it's able to flourish in regions as cool as the Loire, as well as other French regions, Mâcon and Savoy. Outside Beaujolais, this grape is chiefly valued in Switzerland. Gamay may well have originated further north than its home, in the Côte d'Or, where it was planted extensively in the 14th century. However, now, it's given away to Chardonnay by a small amount. Gamay wines, most of which are for young drinking, tend to be light purple and relatively high in acidity, low tannins, and the aromas of fresh red fruits often layered with bananas, boiled sweets. Gamay excels in the rolling hillsides of Haute Beaujolais on the granite-based soil. It's here that the finest wines are produced from the 10 Beaujolais crews, such as Fleury and Morgon. That ends the spotlight on Gamay. Now you've had three different spotlights. Technical piece on oak barrels we covered 2 to 5 weeks ago. A book review on Jancis Robinson's World Wine Atlas. And a spotlight on region and producer. I hope to intend to cycle through these different spotlights over a period of a month or so. And if you have any ideas for any spotlights, do drop me a line. I'm hoping for something that's quite short, sharp, and fact-based. Short, sharp, and fact-based sounds a bit like our next guest, Ernst Lucen. Although Ernst is a nice, jovial bloke, so perhaps maybe not so sharp. He is a wee bit short, and the interview did have some great facts in it. Ernst is a wine producer from Germany and spends quite a bit of time focused on the Riesling grape, not just in his native Mosel, but also in Washington, USA. So, let's have a listen to what Ernst has to say about Riesling. Hi, I'm here with Ernst Lucen, man from Germany and Riesling King. How are you, Ernst?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Excellent. What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about yourself and a wee bit about Riesling as well as a great variety and maybe how it can express itself from soils, etc. How did you get into wine, Ernst?
Well, I mean, that's pretty simple. I inherited a wine estate because, you know, our family is about 200 years in the wine business, you know. So in 1988, my father became very sick, and so somebody, we are a Catholic family, you know, six kids, you know, and somebody has to take over the winery. And so when I studied archaeology, and so all my brothers and sisters said, oh God, you have to do the winery because you're going on social welfare anyway, because you can't get a job. I think it's even in this country difficult to get a job as an archaeologist.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but I'm very happy, you know. It's a wonderful old traditional estate, as I said, 200 years in the family. Wonderful Grand Cru vineyards along the Mosel, you know, along the Middle Mosel. We are from Bernkastel, which is just right in the Middle Mosel. We have six Grand Cru vineyards, beautiful vineyards in the traditional steep slopes, you know. Yep. Old vines. I mean, all these wines are still uncrafted. That means original rootstocks. We don't have any, you know, American rootstocks because this little nasty phylloxera laus wasn't yet in our area. So this is a real rarity for whole of Europe, you know. And so from that point of view, it was fantastic to get, to have these vineyards, you know.
Sure. Okay, sounds very good. You're mainly Riesling. Do you grow any other grapes?
Well, in the Mosel, we grow with the Dr. Losen estate. We grow only Riesling, you know. This is the most traditional grape variety in the area, and this is what the Mosel is famous for the Riesling. Sure. And 200 years ago, it was this old Archbishop of Trier, Clemens Wenceslaus, who introduced the Riesling as the single varietal for the Mosel. So there's a 200-year tradition for Riesling in our area. But we do have a second wine estate on the Rhine River, just north of Elsass on the German side. It's called the Pfalz area, the Pfalz region or the Palatinate. And here you have pretty much the same tradition as in Elsass because it's so close together, beside of Riesling, which has a very long tradition in the Pfalz too. But beside of Riesling, you have also Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Silvaner, Gewürztraminer, all these grape varieties you also find, Pinot Noir, you also find in Elsass. So from that point of view, in the Mosel, only Riesling, but in the Pfalz, Riesling, plus the other traditional varietals like Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Noir, Gewürztraminer, and Silvaner.
Excellent, excellent. So Do you grow Riesling in Mosel, Pfalz, and anywhere else?
Yes, in Washington State.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, we do have a joint venture there with the largest estate in Washington and Seattle. It's called Chateau Saint Michel. And since 1999, we have a joint venture, and we're doing Riesling together because Chateau Saint Michel or Washington is famous for their Riesling. They built their reputation 30 years ago on Riesling. And we produce a Riesling there, which is called Eroica Riesling, Chateau Saint Michel and Dr. Losen. And it became the most successful American Riesling now in America.
Is that partly to do with your reputation?
Definitely I brought some new ideas into it. I wouldn't say, and I want to make it really clear, it is not the way that me as an old world guy coming to the new world and say, oh, you guys don't know anything. And I learned a lot from these guys, you know. But I think what we did, we brought the best together. We brought the best from the old world together with the best from the new world, you know. Mm-hmm. And we have been discussing everything, and I have a wonderful relationship to the winemaker there. And so I think it is a real wonderful collaboration, you know, that we really created a Riesling which we think is typical for Washington State, because before that nobody had been thinking about it. What is typical for Washington State?
How should
a Washington State Riesling look like? We all know how a Riesling from the Mosel should taste like. Or how a Pfalz Riesling should taste like, or a Rheingau or an Austrian Riesling or Alsatian Riesling should taste like. But nobody had a clue what makes a real great Washington State Riesling. And I think this little collaboration put us a lot of steps forward to create the style for Riesling in Washington State.
And what is that style?
It's different to Mosel or Pfalz, so it's not bone dry, as we find it rather in the south of Germany or in Austria, you know. It is, say, kind of, we see that something like 12, 15 gram residual sweetness, which is what we would call medium dry, you know, suits these wines best. Sweeter doesn't work, drier didn't really work. And so something like 12% alcohol, you know. So I would rather think it is his own style, you know. It's difficult to compare it now to say, oh, it's like Pfalz or Elsass.
What about the flavor profiles coming through?
Oh, the flavor profile is also a little bit different. We have rather more these yellow stone fruit aromas, you know, in the Mosel.
Apricots.
Yeah, apricot and sometimes this yellow peach, you know, and mango and these kind of stuff, you know. In the Mosel, we rather have this green apple, you know, or white peach fruit aromas, you know, sometimes cassis and so, you know. And so we have rather this more riper, so yellow fruit, stone fruit aroma structures there in Washington.
Do you think that's a function of the climate? Because obviously you said it was a bit riper, so usually if you leave the grapes on a wee bit longer, you get higher ripeness?
I think this is quite a nice expression as the French use the terroir. A lot of people think terroir is only soil.
Yeah.
It's not only the soil. I mean, soil is also an important part of it. But with terroir, I think the French describes everything. It is the soil, the microclimate, you know, exposure, inclination of sun, drainage of the soil, all these different factors which creates the unique taste or style of the wine, you know. And it is definitely very important, because it is not only the soil. You couldn't go and say, I have now three buckets, one with this soil, one with this soil, and one with this soil, and put the same grape in there, you know, and then all the three are different, you know. It is very important also to respect the microclimate, you know, and the drainage, and, I mean, exposure, inclination, all these things, you know.
You see in Sauvignon Blancs, New Zealand, the longer the hang time on the vine, you do see a development of different flavor compounds coming through the
absolutely,
wine.
Absolutely, you know, exactly.
And does Riesling express this similarly?
It's absolutely, you know. It is definitely something very important with Riesling, as, by the way, with Pinot Noir. Both are cool climate grapes, you know. Mm-hmm. So Riesling really doesn't work in too hot of a climate.
Yep.
You need at least cool. It can be hot during the day, but you need cool nights. Because all what's about Riesling is the acidity. The backbone of Riesling is the acidity, you know. And if you don't get the acidity with the Riesling, then it's a boring wine, you know. And that's, by the way, a little bit with Pinot Noir too. Therefore, Pinot Noir and Riesling has a lot of things in similarity, you know, in common, you know. And for example, in Washington, you know, we have pretty hot because it's a kind of a desert, you know. I mean, you know, and we have hot days, but we have very cool nights, and therefore we get the backbone of the acidity. And this is the same if you look to the great Rieslings, they're always northerly corn, you know?
Northern
areas corn, you know?
In the southern hemisphere, southern areas.
Or there. And because if you look to Rieslings, for example, in California, it's too warm. The nights are too warm, so they burn the acidity, and the wines are pretty uninteresting.
Yeah, so the acidity goes first before the flavors develop?
Yeah, I mean, Riesling needs the acidity to express itself and to express the flavors, you know?
Sure.
A Riesling without any acidity is a pretty boring wine, but I would think that every wine without acidity is pretty boring.
I do like a wine with a nice backbone of acidity.
Yeah, because the acidity is also very important for the ageability, you know, of the wine, you know?
Yeah, because it's a preservative, isn't it? It helps the wine age. Talking about the terroir, you've got, in your notes, you've got different soils. You seem to have about three different types of soils.
In the Mosel, with the Dr. Losen estate, we have three different types of soil. We have the classic, the typical slate soil, the Devonian from Devonian time, you know. I think it's something like 400 million years old, Devon time, but I'm not a geologist.
You're an archaeologist.
Archaeologist, but not a geologist. I didn't do geology. So we have different types of slate. We have in the area between Bernkastel, Krach, and Velen, you know, we have blue slate or gray slate.
Yep.
Then we have another vineyard in Erzig, in the village of Erzig. It's the Würzgarten vineyard, which means spice garden vineyard, you know. Here we have red volcanic soil, you know, which is quite an exception for the Mosel, you know. And then a little bit further, the next village in Erden, you know, the Treption vineyard, the little staircase vineyard. They built little staircases in the vineyard, you know, so they named it Treption, the little staircase vineyard. Here we have red slate. Here we have a high content of iron in the slate, which oxidized and turned the slate into a red color.
Yep.
But these three different soil types, you know, just give different flavors and character to the wine.
Can you describe the different flavors?
Yeah, it's pretty easy, basically, you know, because with the blue slate, with the gray blue slate, you know, and, you know, schist is very fragile, so the slate is very fragile. We have only 1 meter maximum, 2-3 feet maximum topsoil, then the pure cliff, the slate cliff starts. So the roots are going very deep into the soil. Here with the blue slate, we rather have these, as I described beforehand, these green stone fruit aromas, often green apple, you know, golden delicious, you know, often, very often golden delicious. We have sometimes white peach, you know, that's also very typical for the gray slate, you know, sometimes a little bit of cassis, you know. With the red slate, the aroma structure is going much more minerally driven. I think it has to do with something with the iron in the soil, which is oxidized. You see that the acidity with the blue slate is more softer and more delicate, you know, and finesse, you know. The acidity with the red slate is much more vibrant, you know, racy, very minerally driven, you know. I always compare these two wines, you know, the wines from the blue slate, that's a ballerina, you know, and the wine from the red slate is rather a kind of a mountain climber, you know.
Yeah.
You know? It's kind of steady, you know. And then the Würzgarten with the red volcanic soil, you know, this is more kind of, especially with age, and that's the reason it's called Würzgarten, Spice Garden, we rather got aroma structures of spices, you know. Often, so Christmas cookie spices, you know, typical German Christmas cookies is this Spekulatius or Printen, you know. There's typical Christmas cookie spices like cardamom, you know, nutmeg, and these kind of stuff, you know, which you find in the Erzurger Würzgarten, you know. And so it's, for me, it's rather a wrestler, you know, and it's pretty muscular, you know.
Yeah.
And the acidities are not that high in this soil. It's more buffered. So from that point of view, you can really describe these wines, I mean, with the different aroma structures and also with different personalities, you know.
Sure. Climatically, are they similar climates?
Yes. They're all south-facing, you know, south-facing slopes, steep slopes, you know, 70 to 80% steepness, you know. Exposure to the south, you know, steep, you know.
Similar cropping levels, similar age.
Because we still have, as I said, all uncrafted wines, you know, all original rootstocks, you know, and the vineyards there in Velen, Krach, Bernkastel, they're all between 70, 80, even up to 100 years old, you know. So from that point of view, analytically, the wines are pretty much the same, you know, because you can compare the cabinet level in between.
Yep.
So the blue slate cabinet, the red slate cabinet, and the Wurzgarten cabinet, you know, from the volcanic soil. So they have the same ripeness. Analysis is pretty much the same, but you see the differences in style and character.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you.
Ernst, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Cheers. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Ernst. Next week, we're talking with Hugo Sharp, the man behind the Oz Wine Show. If you've never listened to the Oz Wine Show, it's a podcast from Australia. We talk with Hugo about his show and the lie of the land in Australia as he sees it. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.